rigidez oral con un auténtico crack de la enseñanza. Tú eliges la hora y la temática de cada clase. Flexibilidad absoluta. Calidad Vaughan 100%. Contrata las clases telefónicas de inglés de Vaughan para tu empresa. Llama al 911-335-831 o entra en grupovaughan.com.
¿Quieres apuntarte a un curso de inglés y no sabes cuál escoger? ¿Por qué no pruebas nuestro curso trimestral de Vaughan? Son solo 3 meses, no pierdes nada y te aseguramos que vas a ganar mucho. 3 meses en los que podrás ver cuál es tu nivel real de inglés. 3 meses en los que trabajarás tu listening y speaking en todo momento. 3 meses en los que subirás ese nivel tanto que... pues que querrás otros 3 meses y otros 3... Entra en grupovaughan.com e infórmate. Curso trimestral de Vaughan. Si tienes alguna duda o necesitas información sobre cualquiera de nuestros cursos, llámanos al 91-133-5833. Repito, 91-133-5833.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Western Civilization. From Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host, my name is Guy Williams, and you are listening to Vaughan Radio. Now, this program is a continuation of my last program on which I was speaking about Herodotus, my hero, Herodotus, the father of history, the one who invented the term history, because before that, what he calls historia, the word he is using means investigation. It means inquiry, pesquisa. It means looking into something. That is how he thought of his own research, and he begins his work by talking about how he is going to perform it, how he's going to show it, he's going to demonstrate, he's going to recite. This is what he means. It's meant to be performed orally, not read, and it is a show designed to help people understand one of the most fundamental problems that at least Herodotus thought existed, and that is the difference between East and West. And he was going to try to explain that because, just, 40 years earlier, there had been a horrendous, horrendous confrontation between the Greeks and the Persians. And the Greeks have to ask themselves, how did they succeed? Was it luck? Was it something intrinsic? This was a burning question. This was an urgent question. And this is the question that Herodotus is trying to begin to answer, although he never really gives us a satisfactory answer. But at least it's a beginning. It's an inquiry. It's an examination. It's a history. In any case, Herodotus is so much more. They believe that, you know, his original training, or maybe his first love, was as a geographer. Because at every point, he's trying to tell us more about the world and about the variety of peoples in the world. All the kinds of things that we might be able to experience if we just went to the right place, or if we were at the right place at the right time. And for example, one of them, talking about the circumnavigation of Africa, something we really wouldn't know about if it weren't for Herodotus. Without Herodotus, we wouldn't have this detail. And yes, some people say this is apocryphal. Some people say you can't really trust this. Of course, Herodotus never saw the proof himself, but somebody must have given him some kind of convincing explanation or evidence, and he includes it. Talking about the Egyptian king, Necho. The Egyptian king, Necho, this is a pharaoh, and we know a lot about Necho, really existed. Necho sent out a fleet manned by a Phoenician crew And yes, the Phoenicians were excellent on the water. They knew how to navigate like no one. They had been outside the gates of Hercules, meaning they had passed from the Mediterranean into the Atlantic. And they knew how to, well, to extract tin. They knew they were the go-betweens. And in Egypt, the Phoenicians were absolutely fundamental to commerce. They were the ones that the Egyptians themselves, although they understood commerce, they liked commerce. Egyptians really didn't want to leave Egypt. And in times of empire, this meant that the administrators were not very happy to be sent away from Egypt, not very happy to be posted, or destinados, to be posted outside of Egypt in conquered areas. And much less the Egyptian merchants. They didn't like to travel that much, while the Phoenicians really did. And so it is absolutely logical that Necho would have used a Phoenician fleet, a Phoenician crew, to sail west and return to Egypt with the Mediterranean by the way of the Pillars of Hercules. So to go down the Red Sea and the Indian Ocean and then around what we call the Cape of Good Hope. In other words, circumnavigating Africa, going, as we say in American English, counterclockwise. In Britain, it's much more anti-clockwise, but in America, we say counterclockwise, right? Around Africa, returning through the Straits of Gibraltar, the Pillars of Hercules. Well, the Phoenicians sailed from the Arabian Gulf. When Herodotus talks about the Arabian Gulf, it's very difficult to know whether he actually means what we call the Persian Gulf or the Red Sea. It's kind of unclear. But in this case, clearly he's talking about the Red Sea. So, the Arabian Gulf into the Southern Ocean, not the Indian Ocean, obviously, into the Southern Ocean, and every autumn they docked or put in or landed at some convenient place on the coast, and they planted the ground there. They waited for the harvest in the following year, and when they had harvested their grain, their cereal, they went out to sea again. They began to sail again. And after two full years, they rounded the Pillars of Hercules. And in the course of the third year, they returned to Egypt. In other words, they did it. They circumnavigated. These men made a statement which I do not myself believe. In other words, Herodotus is not afraid to repeat something and indicate that he himself is skeptical. In other words, unlike many, many writers, he is interested in our critical thinking. He is trying to foment this skepticism in us. And this is very rare in a writer, and very, very rare in a writer from the ancient world, who is much more interested in convincing us or forcing us to believe what he's saying, rather than fomenting our critical thinking. He says, these men made a statement which I do not myself believe, although others may, to the effect that as they sailed west, round the southern end of Africa, they had their sun on the right. In other words, with Herodotus and everybody Herodotus ever knew, and anybody in Western civilization itself, we know that the sun tends to be in the south. Well, who ever heard of the sun being in the north? And here you have these Phoenicians talking about the sun in the north. Herodotus himself doesn't believe it. But we have to. I mean, why would they talk about the sun being in the north if it weren't true? These people, absolutely, they must have gone around the Cape of Good Hope. And so, thanks to Herodotus, the entire ancient world, because he was read again and again, one of the most popular authors, throughout history, educated people have been intimately familiar with Herodotus and his histories. And so, yes, nobody doubted this circumnavigation of Africa and the idea that the earth was round, because the only way this could be true, really, is either the sun is much, much closer to the earth than we believe, or the earth has to be round. Well, if the story is correct, again, Africa first circumnavigated 2,000 years before Vasco da Gama was sent out from Portugal. So, speaking of Africa, Herodotus tells us that you've got, you've got this case. He says, there's a certain citizen of Cyrene. Cyrene is in Africa. It is in, I believe what is today Libya, right? The city of Cyrene. It's, the Nile Delta where much, much later, where Alexandria was going to be founded. You've got the Nile Delta, and then you've got a long, long stretch of desert with no civilization really whatsoever. And then, on the Libyan coast, you have Cyrene. Well, and Cyrene was a very big city in its day. There was a citizen of Cyrene, and he was going to the shrine of Amun. Herodotus doesn't know it, but this famous shrine of Amun is going to be visited much, much later by Alexander the Great. This is where Alexander the Great gets the information directly from the oracle, well, actually from the god himself, that Alexander the Great is divine. This, of course, confirms what Alexander suspected all along, that his origins were not mortal. In any case, this famous shrine of Amun, located in the desert, had a certain characteristic in that there was a chemical precipitation within the god's cele, within the god's location, the special sanctuary, the special sanctuary of the god. You had this sort of chemical reaction with a salt crystallizing there, and it was called, because of the god, because of Amun, it was called ammonia. And yes, that is where we get the word ammonia, precisely from this temple. So, the citizen of Cyrene, visiting the shrine or temple of Amun, started talking to Etearchus, the king of that area, the Ammonian king. And in just a simple conversation. They started talking about the Nile and how, interestingly, no one had actually ever found the source of the Nile. Now, Idiarchus started telling the following story. Once upon a time, this is how we begin the fairy tales. This is how we begin, cuentos de hadas. Once upon a time, it's how we begin children's stories. This is a formula. Érase una vez. But of course, in Herodotus, Herodotus wants us to believe this. So he says, there was a time when some wild young men, uncontrolled, impulsive, they had a kind of lottery. They drew lots, right? Each one his part. And una rifa. Lots for them to explore the desert parts of Libya and to try to go into the interior where no man had ever gone before. These young men were sent off on their mission by their comrades, the lucky ones or the unlucky ones. But yes, among a group of young men, the ones chosen by chance at random were sent off well equipped with supplies of water and food. They entered into the desert region, which they began to cross, traveling from east to west. And they reached an expanse of sand. They had to journey for many days. Actually, in English, that's redundant because the idea of journey, journey viene de jornada, right? A journey is a trip that takes multiple days. We don't use this word very much anymore because there are no journeys anymore. You can practically go around the world in 24 hours today. And so it's all trip. Traditionally in English, the word for viaje was journey on land and voyage by sea. So yes, the voyage of Sinbad, but the journey of these men across the desert. Today, in the 21st century, when you hear journey, it is almost always metaphorical, right? The culmination of my life's work has been a long journey, something like that, right? A metaphor. In any case, you've got, they journeyed for many days, and at last they came to a plain, llanura, where they could observe trees. They went to see the trees, and seeing the fruit on them, they immediately started to pick that fruit. This is obviously an oasis in the middle of the desert. So, while they were picking the fruit, a number of men came up. These men were very short, much shorter than average. They took prisoners of their travelers, and they carried them away physically. The Libyans could not understand even a word of the language that they spoke. And, well, they were taken to a town. Everybody in this town was very, very short. Nobody taller than the men who had originally taken them away from the oasis. And their skins were black. There was a great river filled with crocodiles flowing past the town, running from west to east. And this is quite clear that we're talking, Herodotus is telling us that these people from Libya, these were the first people we know of in contact with pygmies. Herodotus told the world that pygmies exist. And so we have to thank him for so many things. Okay, on my last program, I was talking about Herodotus, and I was talking about toward the beginning of the book, toward the beginning of his history, he mentions Croesus, and he mentions, I'll be talking about this on the second part of the program, but he mentions the interview with Solon. Solon, the great archon, the great lawgiver of Athens. And I mentioned that one of the great things that Solon had done while he was given dictatorial powers in Athens to completely change anything that he saw fit. Everybody trusted him to do the best thing that he knew how to do, the best as he saw it. And he changed the laws, but he also was able to convince the ruling class there, the propertied class, the noble class, to believe in commerce, which is something the noble class normally doesn't do. The nobility, based on landed aristocracy, again and again, tries to resist the rise of a commercial class. You can see this in history again and again. In England, it is absolutely patent. I mean, there were, you know, the whole 19th century, 18th and 19th century, you have a series of braguetazos, no? The idea of a rising commercial class marrying into the aristocracy. This happened in Spain as well during the 18th and especially the 19th century, right? New money marrying old money. The advenedizos, right? The parvenus from commerce, from trade, who acquire quite a bit. They look for the prestige, let's put it that way, the status of old money. And so they get married. But there's always resistance. And I mentioned as well this tendency, which many people, not just me, but historians, have traditionally said was absolutely fatal for the Spanish Empire. This disdain for earning a living so that you could not be a hidalgo and earn a living. Hidalguía and commerce were absolutely opposed. And this was, again, it extended all the way through the Spanish Empire, this idea, and generation after generation, century after century. There are many reasons for it, but it was a terrible, terrible obstacle to, let's call it, progress in the Spanish Empire. Okay, I mentioned this on my last program, and people complained. All right, I received two complaints. How's that? I received two complaints about the, you know, that this is La Leyenda Negra, and this is, well, it really isn't. In areas like Athens, as I mentioned, or last year I was talking about the Low Countries. I was talking about when Holland broke away from the Spanish Empire. They didn't have much land. Much of the land they had was reclaimed from the sea, and so there was no there was no basis for a landed aristocracy. These are the people who had to innovate. These are the people who had to be clever. These are the people who had to put their faith in commerce. And as a result, they invented all sorts of innovations in finance, in insurance, in investment. And many people talk about this Dutch Renaissance as the beginnings of modern capitalism, finance capitalism, because they had no other source of income, no gold mines, no ranches, no estates. And so, yeah, they had to be innovative. Well, the Athenians had to do exactly the same thing. And that's what I was mentioning on the program. I did not mean to offend, but it is a constant in country after country. The landed class, or the aristocratic class, or the class with lots of money, has to become enthusiastic at one point about investing, about making risky investments, commercial investments, in intercontinental commerce. And this is the beginning of let's call it the vitality characteristic of later times. Well, in this case, it was Solon who did this for Athens. Okay, I have to take a break. I'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
Los profesionales de su empresa no comunican eficazmente en inglés, su empresa no necesita clases de inglés. Su empresa necesita una solución y la necesita urgentemente. Muchas son las empresas españolas que despilfarran el dinero contratando clases de inglés a diestro y siniestro. Café para todos y resultados para nadie. Dominar el inglés requiere enfoque, esfuerzo y un plan. En Baugen Empresas tenemos un plan hecho a medida para su empresa. No nos interesa vender clases, nos interesa conseguir soluciones. Y para ello, tenemos un apasionado equipo de profesores formados meticulosamente en el método Baugen. Llama al 911-335831, 911-335831. Su empresa necesita una solución y la necesita urgentemente.
Hey, have you heard about our trimestrales? No? Well, let me tell you all about them. The program lasts 3 months. Eso es, dura 3 meses. Many different timetables to choose from. From Monday to Friday, Saturdays in the morning. And you'll have plenty of homework. And your teacher will correct your homework and check it to make sure you're making progress. Find out more now. Our trimestrales at Vaughan. Small groups, only 4 to 6 students per class, and the class is focused on speaking and using the language. Contact us and find out about trimestrales with one of our dynamic Vaughan teachers. You won't regret it. No te arrepentirás. More information at GrupoVaughan.com.
Sin prisa, pero sin pausa. This is the Spanish expression that I use when people ask me what they should do with their children concerning English. Sin prisa pero sin pausa. The target date for English mastery is age 23. Children and adolescents don't need English, really, until they reach adulthood, until they finish their studies and start looking for their first job. This is usually at the age of 23. If they don't know English well at this point, they are in trouble. They have a problem, an important problem. If they don't know English well at the age of 23, when they enter the labor market, they will probably never reach a decent level, a good working level of English. So, as a mother or father, you need to make sure that your children gain a good command of English by the age of 23 at the latest. This means that when the child is born, you have 23 years to solve the problem. Are you capable of solving a problem if you have a 23-year window to solve it? I hope so. Here in Vaughn Systems, we provide kids, children, with dynamic verbal access to English starting at the age of 4. We expose the children to the native sound of the language, and we work especially hard to promote effective listening comprehension and to make the language fun and attractive for the children. Entrust your children to us, little by little, slowly but surely, sin prisa pero sin pausa. We will transform them into bilingual adolescents and prepare them for age 23. Contact Vaughan Jr.
Más información sobre la línea Junior de Vaughan Systems en el teléfono 91-133-5832. 91-133-5832.
Si tienes alguna duda o necesitas información sobre cualquiera de nuestros cursos, llámanos al 91-133-5833. Repito, 91-133-5833.
El Máster en Inglés Profesional te ofrece este programa.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host. My name is Guy Williams, and you are listening to Vaughn Radio. Now, on the first part of the program, I was talking about Herodotus and how, in his history, in the course of his history, we learn so much, not just about his main concern, being the seeming incompatibility of East and West, but also about all kinds of different and strange places that other people in the ancient world, certainly in ancient Greece, they never would have known about if it hadn't been for this man and his travels and what he reports, what he tells us, what he saw, and what he wrote down. And I was talking about Africa on the first part of the program. Then I mentioned some feedback, right? Retroalimentación, or what are críticas? I mentioned some feedback. I am always responsive to feedback, and so my listeners talked to me, and one of them mentioned that on my last program, speaking about Croesus of Lydia and Croesus of Sardis and his interview with Solon of Athens, and how Croesus was looking for any pretext to fight against the different city-states of Ionian Greece. Principal among them being Ephesus. And I spoke about Ephesus as home of one of the seven wonders of the world, the Temple of Artemis. Temple of Artemis at Ephesus. And yes, one of my listeners has asked me to go over the seven wonders of the world again, just mention them in passing. And yeah, the Temple of Artemis at Ephesus was perhaps the biggest temple of its day. Many of these city-states, especially the prosperous ones, remember that Ephesus at that time was a seaport. Today it's something like 2 kilometers from the Mediterranean. But at that time, Ephesus was a seaport and enormously prosperous, fabulously wealthy. Croesus, whose temple to Artemis measured 100 meters long by 55 meters wide. Well, Croesus did that for Ephesus. Now, for 200 years, that temple was there. But, again, it was burned down. I mentioned this on the program. It was burned down in an act of vandalism by somebody who wanted to go down. This is what we say, go down in history, go down in the annals of history. Somebody who wanted to appear, somebody who wanted that fame, even if it were only for vandalism. And of course, historians subsequently erase his name. They don't like him. The only people I know who spoke of this person well, this vandal, the person who burnt down the temple of Artemis, the only people were the Nazis. Hitler and his inner circle, they mentioned him. They thought that what he had done was perfectly comprehensible. In any case, allegedly, the Temple of Artemis burnt down the exact night that Alexander the Great was born. And so, yes, subsequently, by the way, the in Ephesus, you had around the temple, you had some kind of a transformation of the landscape so that it became wetter and wetter. And finally, there was malaria. And there was malaria there. People didn't want to go there anymore. And for that reason, the whole area was, it was never really recovered. Not even in Roman times. But there were other temples considered among the seven wonders of the world. For example, the temple to Zeus in Athens. Oh, Olympia, sorry. The temple of Zeus in Olympia. And that was something spectacular. The Olympic Games began at a very low level in 776 BC and began to grow slowly, steadily, until toward the end. I mean, they were considered they were very celebrated. They commissioned Phidias of Athens. So yeah, Phidias, who, if I remember correctly, Phidias is the one with the Parthenon, right? The temple to Athena. But they commissioned Phidias of Athens to create a statue of the god. And you can see Zeus on his throne, 12 meters tall and 6 meters wide. Now, remember that unlike churches, for example, this is the big innovation in Christianity, right? A church was for everybody. A church was for the worshipers, actually for the Christians, the catechumenos, or the other people. They were supposed to be outside, but the faithful were supposed to be inside the church, and this was a complete innovation, because before that, access to a temple was restricted, and anything you wanted to do, you did in front of the temple. So yes, you wanted to make a sacrifice, you wanted to celebrate some kind of ceremony. If only priests and only the ones who were authorized to be in the presence of the gods could actually enter the temple. And in the temple, of course, there was a hierarchy with access to the statue of the god restricted to the highest members of that hierarchy. So yeah, Zeus lasted longer than the Olympics, right? The Olympics themselves were abolished in late antiquity. The Olympics, actually physical activity itself was considered incompatible with Christianity. Athletics was, you know, athletics is the concern of athletics is mostly this world, whereas Christianity, the chief concern is the next world. And so, yeah, it was considered incompatible. And the statue was moved to Constantinople in the year 462. It was destroyed by a fire. So, we have a temple and a statue. We have the pyramid. Remember that when we're talking about this time, the pyramid was so much older than any of the other things we're talking about. The pyramid was from about 2500 BC. When Herodotus looked at it in 450 BC, it was already 2,000 years old. So yeah, when Herodotus was looking at the pyramid was as old as, for example, the Roman Colosseum is for us. So yes, you can imagine. The pyramid has 2,250,000 stone blocks. Each of those stone blocks weighs over 2 tons. There are no other buildings on Earth. There are many other pyramids on Earth, but no other buildings on Earth that are like that or anywhere near like that. And so, yes, that is the Great Pyramid at Giza. And in Herodotus's hometown, the place he was from, what today is called Bodrum in Turkey. Next to Bodrum, well, you've got the place that used to be called Halicarnassus. The king of Halicarnassus was called Mausolus. His sister and his wife were heartbroken when Mausolus died. Of course, his sister was his wife. It was actually a lot more common in the ancient world. And it is the one way to keep the bloodline going. In any case, his sister wife built this building for her husband brother in the form of a tomb just outside the royal capital on the top of the hill. And it was a work that went on year after year after year. They understood that they were making something very, very special. This was, the tomb was completed much, much later after she had died, but everybody who worked on it understood how magnificent it was going to be, one of the seven wonders of the world. In the 14th century, at about the time of the plague, right, bubonic plague, the tomb was destroyed by earthquakes. And parts of it are in the British Museum. The Tomb to Mausolus is famous in our language because we tend to still to talk about a mausoleum. That is a vestige, that is a fossil in our language, reflected in the way we speak. Now, you've got another statue, the Colossus. Any Colossus, by definition, a Colossus is a large statue, larger than life. This Colossus was in Rome. You remember, I was just talking about, not Rome, Rhodes, Rome. Rome had the Roman Colosseum, right? That Colosseum came from the word Colossus. And that was the Colossus that Nero commissioned for himself. This was not one of the seven wonders of the world, but it was a Colossus. You had Nero, larger than life, probably bigger than the Colossus of Rhodes. In any case, a little like the Statue of Liberty. Let's put it that way. And Nero he had himself sculpted as the Sol Invictus, I think, or he had a big star on his head, in any case, or the sign of the sun on his head. And that was right in the middle of his garden, in his palace, which he constructed after Rome had burnt. He took the very best part of Rome and used it for his own palace and his own use. And so he had a park right in the middle of Rome, a private park, so that anybody who wanted to get from point A to point B in Rome, they had to go around Nero's property. In any case, as soon as Nero was gone, that statue came down. And where you had a Colossus, well, Vespasian put up an amphitheater and called it the Colosseum because it was where the Colossus had been. This Colossus, one of the seven wonders of the world, was on the island of Rhodes. Now, I mentioned about the same size as the Statue of Liberty. And this time it did represent the sun god Helios. And the result was spectacular. They like to say that it had one leg on each side of the harbor, and so all of the sails, ships that sailed in or out, all of the ships navigating in that harbor had to pass under the legs of the Colossus. Well, this isn't true. The real Colossus was kept aside from the harbor, a little like the Statue of Liberty in the Hudson River. In any case, the Colossus was only there for just a couple of generations before it was destroyed by an earthquake. And yes, it was broken up and reused. Then we have the Great Lighthouse at Alexandria. The lighthouse called Pharos in Greece. Pharos is, something to be seen. It's like a landmark. It's something, algo que se destaca, no? And, Pharos, which of course gives us the Spanish word for lighthouse, faro. This was the original one. The lighthouse was there to help ships to go along the Egyptian coast without running into things, without wrecking sinking. And the Romans were the ones to add a fire, right? Before then, it was just a tower. It was the Romans who decided to add a fire and a mirror, making it visible at night. The lighthouse, of course, destroyed by earthquakes in the 14th century, in the same time as the la peste, as the plague. And then finally, the other big one, we talked about Egypt. This is going to be Mesopotamia, because the others are in the Greek part, you know, the eastern Mediterranean, whereas ancient Egypt gave us the pyramid at Giza, and Babylon gave us the Hanging Garden. This was built by Nebuchadnezzar II. His wife missed her homeland, missed the mountain country. There she was in the middle of the desert, and she felt so bad. So that Nebuchadnezzar ordered the construction of a kind of a microclimate so that she would not feel nostalgia. So, the gardens were actually bóvedas, no? They were vaults rather than actual gardens. There were terraces there. Now, these were covered with earth, with very, very large trees. And the result was very pleasing, evidently satisfactory to Nebuchadnezzar's wife. But yes, this is what happened in Babylon, and these are the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. Recent archaeological examinations, well, they have, the excavations have uncovered quite a lot about the hydrological basis for all of this. How they were able to bring so much water to make the desert bloom so artificially. But yes, these are the seven wonders of the world. And it's now that we're talking about Herodotus, we should be talking about that. But as I say, Herodotus's big notion, Herodotus's what he actually wants to talk about is not geography and certainly not geographical curiosities. He is much, much more interested in the incompatibility, the idea that in the East, in Mesopotamia, they believe that the Greek way of life is fundamentally incompatible with their own. And why would they go all the way to destroy Greece? What is it? East is east and west is west, and there cannot be any sort of connection. Obviously, there was the Greek areas in the Persian Empire were loyal to the Persian Empire. The Greek areas in the Persian Empire assimilated quite well, and fought loyally with the Persians against their fellow Greeks. Again, this is not something that somebody like Herodotus wants to mention openly, but everybody knew. Everybody knew it happened. One of the reasons, perhaps, is this the uniqueness of this Greek way of thinking. Subsequently, philosophers, people like Hegel, Hegel said that the history of the entire world was in the balance. The history of the entire world depended on this moment, on the resistance of the Greeks, on Salamis and Thermopylae, Plataea, all of these battles against the Persians. Without that, or with another outcome, if the Greeks had failed, if the Greeks had been defeated, then world history would be completely, completely different, or at least according to Hegel. In England, the philosopher John Stuart Mill said that Marathon, the Battle of Marathon, the battle, again, of the resistance by the Greeks, in this case, by the Athenians, against the Persians. This Battle of Marathon is more important to British history than the Norman Conquest, than the Battle of Hastings in 1066, where the Anglo-Saxons lost and the Normans began to take over and change absolutely everything, making Britain a hybrid of cultures, just a complete mixture of, in many ways, incompatible cultures. Well, that is the single most important moment in British history. But no, John Stuart Mill says that the Battle of Marathon, the Greek resistance against the Persians, is actually more important to British history than the Battle of Hastings. Okay, I've run out of time. Thank you for listening, and please listen to my next program.
Pásate a vernos a la tienda de Vaughan.